I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Coming up a little bit later in the hour, Christopher Sutherland talks about his book, In My Footsteps, A Cape Cod Travel Guide. But first, land conservation is important for a variety of reasons, from protecting habitats to ecosystems. Today, we discuss an effort of the Harwich Conservation Trust to purchase a 49-acre parcel in East Harwich along Pleasant Bay. Joining us in studio is Michael Locke, Executive Director of the Harwich Conservation Trust. Good morning.
Thanks, Mindy.
Scott Ridley, author and historian. His book, Morning of Fire, John Kendrick's Daring American Odyssey in the Pacific. Good morning, Scott.
Morning, Tim.
And on the phone, longtime Orleans summer resident Timothy Earle, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at Northwestern University, who hopes to organize archaeological research on this property to illuminate the local history of Harwich over the last 500 years from Native American Indian uses through the colonial and 19th century periods. Welcome, Tim, to the program.
Oh, it's great to be here.
All right, Michael, there's several reasons why there's so much interest in this piece of property. Let's talk about them. First, its importance to protecting water quality. This sits right along Pleasant Bay.
It's actually about 1,000 feet back from Round Cove, which is an embayment of Pleasant Bay. And we're calling this our Pleasant Bay Woodlands Project with a goal to raise $3.6 million by August to purchase and preserve the 49-acre landscape that includes the largest remaining undeveloped, unprotected property in the entire 21,000-acre Pleasant Bay watershed, which spans the towns of Harwich, Orleans, Chatham, and Brewster.
So talk about specifically how this would protect water quality.
This property happens to feed groundwater as well as even seasonal surface flow directly into Round Cove on Pleasant Bay. We know that our coastal waters, including Pleasant Bay, have been suffering for a long time from nutrient loading, nitrogen, flowing from septic systems primarily. And if this property isn't preserved, it could be occupied by a subdivision of up to 40 lots, which would certainly adversely impact water quality.
All right, so the property has also some potential archaeological importance. Tim, it lies on the edge of a glacial outwash plain. So tell us what that means and why it's important.
Well, as I'm sure you understand, the Cape is not doesn't have any base to it, rock base to it. It is a glacial creation. And at the edge of the glacier, you had an outwash as it melted that created a light soil, but one which is very fertile and would have been used for agriculture and a whole range of other things from early times.
Yeah. And this could potentially have archaeological sites dating back how far? Thousands of years?
Well, the area would have been occupied probably around 10,000 years ago.
Wow.
So it has that potential, though the actual numbers of people at the early period would have been very low. It becomes increasingly important through time. One of the things that I would love to see is looking at how the environment change. So this is called a woodlands project, but of course, as an archaeologist, I know that it hasn't been woodlands over those 10,000 years. There was a period where it became woodlands. The woodlands were cleared for farming. They were used in all sorts of ways. It probably was completely deforested for a long period of time, and then it has come back. So there's a whole history of the environmental change that is represented by this landscape.
Mm. And the other thing that's interesting here is there's a documented list of identifiable owners. So dating how far back?
About 17. Actually, Scott, you would know that.
Yeah, if you look at this, it's one of the unique features of this property is that on most of the Cape properties, we've had the deeds on the Cape burned over a couple of times, and so it's hard to trace anything back. But this is one of those unique properties where we can actually see what the deeds were and the fact that Edward Kenrick purchased this from Native Americans around 1730. And then you can even trace some of the Native American families back all the way to Mattaquaison, who was here when the Pilgrims arrived.
Yeah.
You can see the whole transition from Native culture into colonial culture and then on from there. So the it's a piece of land that tells an incredible story. And part of the story is archaeological, part of it's historical, and you can weave those together.
Yeah, and this is unusual, right? We don't usually find that you can. And there's actually still a house on the property that belonged to the Kendricks?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Scott, tell us who the Kendricks were, because you wrote a book on John Kendrick, but there's Edward, as you're mentioning. And
Edward Kendrick came to the Cape around 1705, and he married into the Snow family, which was a prominent family that came down from Plymouth. Nicholas Snow in Orleans was one of the patriarchs of the Lower Cape, and his progeny spread all over from Truro and Provincetown all the way up through Harwich. And so through that marriage, he gained access to capital and credit, and he was listed as a weaver at the time and a trader, but he was buying and selling land with a lot of Native Americans. He became a good friend of many Native Americans. There were testimonies of their friendships in various local histories. And his son Solomon settled on that land sometime in the late 1730s, and John Kendrick and all of his children were born there, according to Harwich historian Josiah Payne and some of the early records of the area.
Mm. And then, of course, John Kendrick, he's sort of been a forgotten character in history. Yet you wrote a book about him, but there's sort of this reemerging interest in him.
Yeah, there's a lot of reemerging interest in Kendrick right now. Kendrick was born in 1740 on that land, or around 1740. He was someone who was known to Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson. He was a privateer during the Revolutionary War, and then he led the first American expedition into the Pacific starting in 1787. And he ended up staging a single ship campaign to hold off the British and Spanish interests in the Pacific. And he purchased at one point 1,000 square miles of land on what's now Vancouver Island and sent the deeds back to Thomas Jefferson, saying this would be a great place to expand the land of democracy and liberty and to bring it out to the West Coast. And he was part of the whole visionary movement at that time of envisioning America is finally populating, the whole continent.
And he was the captain that was chosen to lead the Columbia expedition.
It was an expedition of two ships. It was the Columbia and the Lady Washington. The Columbia only remained out there for the first 2 years, and he remained alone with the Lady Washington and a small crew, trading from the Pacific Northwest through Hawaii to Macau in China. He was the first American to enter Japan with an American flag and to try and trade there. Japan had been a closed nation at that time for 150 years to all foreigners, and it raised quite a stir that he came there. There's a memorial to his visit that's in Kashima, Japan. And last summer, as a matter of fact, Japanese historian Kozu Sayama came and visited. He visited Mike and the land, and he visited me, and we've been corresponding. He's writing more history on Kendrick, and there's quite an interest in Japan and Kendrick as well, being the first American to visit there.
One of the interesting things I find is that there's no image of John Kendrick, but we do have descriptions of him. But, most sea captains, we have a portrait somewhere. There's something. That's kind of unusual that we don't have any images.
Well, this was very early on. We're talking about, 1740s through 1770s, and there may have been some images at one time. Families disperse, things get destroyed. There were fires, undoubtedly, in some of the homes. So we have no verifiable images of him at this point in time.
Yeah. And another thing we should mention, he had a different style as a captain than many other captains.
He did, yeah. He came from below decks. He served with Native American crews on whaling ships. His father was a whaler, beginning in the 1730s, and he served on whaling crews. He probably went to sea with his father and his relatives around the time he was 12 to 14. And he became a master of whaling ships, and he became a friend of Native Americans as well. And it's something that's reflected later on when he's out in the Pacific Northwest forming alliances with Native people out there to try and hold off the Spanish and the British.
And Tim, your summer home here in Orleans is a Kendrick house.
It is a Kendrick house, so it would have been the location where John Kendrick's father either would have been born or grew up. So the house would have been built in the sometime before 1730. It's It then was rebuilt by Kendrick in the in 1792. It's a beautiful old Cape Cod house, right on Route 28. Yeah.
So tell us about the house that's on this property. What kind of condition is it in?
It's not in good condition, and it is not from the outside. I haven't been inside, but there's nothing on the outside that suggests that it is a it is an older house than the 19th century. But one of the things that I would love to do is to get in there and see whether there is a skeleton of an earlier house that still exists in there.
Yeah, family tradition holds that the house was either built on the site of the earliest house there, or that some of the framing materials and boards from the earlier house are incorporated into that house. And the latter is probably true, because that happened all the time when the Cape people were moving houses around and saving nails, which were a precious commodity. And when they had boards available, they didn't have to get into a saw pit and saw new boards. So,
Tim, I know there's a lot.
The house that that I have in Orleans, it, although we know it was largely rebuilt in 1792, it incorporates in it materials that would be back to the 1720s and 30s.
The house that's on the 49-acre site, unfortunately, is in severe disrepair. The roof is has holes in it. It's been open to the weather.
Animals in there.
Yes. We've actually had an architect render an opinion about the structural safety of the...
So it would probably come down.
It would probably have to be removed.
But before it would come down, Tim would get to go in there, right, Tim? And so, Tim, just from talking about that historical aspect, because I know there's other things that we want to look at archaeologically in this parcel of land, but what, I mean, would you dig in the ground? I mean, how would you approach that? Obviously, there's the things, the house itself and in there, but I would imagine they'd have some sort of buried trash. There would be things that you could find in the land around the house.
Well, I mean, I think that what was laid out by Scott is a marvelous history that we can know from the written record, but it tells us absolutely nothing about what the people were doing there, you know, on a daily basis, their daily lives. And so this is one of the great things about historic archaeology, whether it's of the Kendrick House or of Jefferson's house. I mean, you immediately find out all of the complexities of things that were going on, and where you can document that is, of course, in the actual kitchen middens. More recently, these were the bottle dumps, and I'm sure there's going to be plenty of that. You get these old kitchen middens going back to the first times, and you would also have the Indian sites. You would have any special work sites that may be associated with the white cedar swamps. I mean, it's the potential for the archaeology there is really extraordinary, and I know this because of the kinds of things that we find on these sites. What's remarkable is that most of the Cape has been developed out, and so this kind of archaeology is lost. This is a very large piece of land that has never been subdivided, so that its whole archaeological history should be well preserved.
Yeah, and so with this rich family history that we're talking about, this could not only have regional significance, but national, right?
Oh, absolutely.
That's right.
Absolutely. So it is, when I think of it, is a microcosm of Cape history, all of the things that went on from the early glacial period right to the modern day. Additionally, made significant because of that national and international significance. I mean, this was Kendrick was involved in a major political play with the British.
And you mentioned the White Cedar Swamp. So we know that the property became important for cranberries, so requiring a major investment in labor to build those bogs. So that alteration from the Great White Cedar Swamp to the Cranberry Bog, and you say that would have happened during Edward Kendrick's ownership of this property.
Well, that was a later Edward Kendrick.
A later Edward Kendrick.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So there's more than one.
Several members of the family named Edward Kendrick.
Okay.
Yeah, he apparently owned the property or held title to it between 1860 and 1880 when there was a lot of transition going on with cranberry bogs. And one of the interesting things, and this is where it weaves in with what Tim is talking about with the archaeological record, when you look at the documentation, you can identify an individual that was there doing it at this time. And then you look further back in the records, and you can see that what was being written into the deeds early on were the Native Americans reserving rights to be able to go into the cedar swamp to strip the bark off because they used that to line the outside of their witus. And so you have this transition of Native Americans still using that property and cooperating with the other white owners at the time. And then slowly those rights, as the Native American people died off, being extinguished, and then it being transitioned into a cranberry bog. So you have this whole evolution of uses of the land, too, that would be reflected in the archaeological record, too.
We're talking about a unique 49-acre parcel of land in East Harwich along Pleasant Bay that the Harwich Conservation Trust is trying to put into conservation. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about Harwich Conservation Trust looking to purchase a 49-acre parcel in East Harwich along Pleasant Bay. We're talking with Michael Locke, Executive Director of the Harwich Conservation Trust, Scott Ridley, author and historian. His book, Morning of Fire, John Kendrick's Daring American Odyssey in the Pacific, and Timothy Earle, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at Northwestern University. So, Michael, how unusual is it to find a property of this size?
You know, the Harwich Conservation Trust conducted a parcel analysis townwide, more than 200 parcels, evaluating different natural resource significance for each parcel to compare their relative importance for conservation purposes. And this property rose to the top of that study. And so we know it's been our top priority for a very long time. It took us 10 years to negotiate an agreement which set the stage for this $3.6 million fundraising effort by August. Hopefully we'll raise those additional funds by then. The good news is on that fundraising effort, $3.6 million sounds like a big number. It is. But fortunately, there has been a group of challenge donors who have combined resources. Those challenge donors include the Wequosset Resort, the John T. Ryan Jr. Memorial Foundation, the Friends of Pleasant Bay, so you have a nonprofit jumping in, as well as three anonymous families. And they have combined resources to create a $1.8 million challenge, which happens to be half of it, 3.6.
So you just have to raise the other half.
Right. Now, what they're willing to do is they're willing to match dollar for dollar every donation that's contributed towards this 49-acre project.
Yeah. So that makes your job a little bit easier.
Right. Every donation is doubled, essentially. Yeah. And with that pledge, plus donations received to date, we have less than 700,000 to go.
Oh, wow. That's good.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and you have until August to do that. So why a decade? Why has it taken so long? What's been happening that it's taken this long?
Well, the owners have had different ideas for the use of this property over that period of time. We've been in discussion with them off and on throughout throughout those 10 years, talking about timing, talking about valuation, talking about development potential. And it's taken a while, but you know, we've persevered and worked out this opportunity. We were able to launch it last year during our 25th anniversary year, which was a great way to embark on such a grand initiative to save this largest remaining undeveloped property in the entire watershed. So we're hopeful with additional support we'll get there.
Tim, how much? I know you've been on the property and explored it a little bit, but obviously you've done some sort of an evaluation to realize this archaeological potential that's there. How big of a project would this be? I mean, would this take years? What's your estimation on what?
This would take years, and the key will be developing a collaboration with the University of Massachusetts. They have this wonderful MA program in historic archaeology with experience on the Cape and throughout the region. And so it would be largely done by kind of an overarching project that would be broken up into a series of MA and PhD projects.
Let's talk about the habitat and its importance to wildlife.
Well, you know, we've been hearing this this intriguing story of the human history associated with land and its potential archaeological significance. It's very important for wildlife, too. It's comprised of forested upland, also wetland pockets, some of which have vernal pool potential. Vernal pools are a very sensitive and vulnerable habitat type that provide resources for specific species. Could be spotted salamander, could be wood frog. In fact, just in a few short weeks, even though it still feels cold and just like winter, we'll be hearing wood frogs chorusing in the area. So that leads one to believe that indeed there are vernal pools near or on the property. And that'll be subject of further study in the future.
Wouldn't that make it not be a developable? I mean, wouldn't things like that, some of the uniqueness of this property, make it that it couldn't be developed?
There are some parts that may have development constraints, but the majority of the property is actually developable upland, hence the possibility of this up to 40-lot subdivision.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. And so what about, you know, the plant life, the, you know, flora and fauna, if you will? Mm-hmm. Do we have any, you know, unusual flora and fauna that we don't find anywhere else?
Perhaps. We don't have a botanical survey conducted yet. We've been talking to actually a local botanist from Chatham who will be visiting the property in the coming months to study the area for plants in different seasons. And so we're looking into that research. We also have really a wildlife corridor effect that could take place if we can preserve this land, because back in 2003, the trust, in partnership with the town and the Trust for Public Land, preserved 42 acres to the south along Monomoy River, also called Muddy Creek, which is also the subject of a tidal restoration project at this moment. And so you have resident and migratory wildlife not only using that 42-acre anchor to the south, but that could also use the 49 acres just to the north across Bay Road.
So what would happen to this property if you reach your goal and you're able to put, I mean, does it just sit there? Do you put, you know, walking paths? I mean, what would its use be?
Well, fortunately, it's large enough to accommodate potential walking trails. So we would look at the availability of existing paths and cart paths, make sure to we would design paths that would take into account the sense of natural resources, but also provide an important visitor experience. Certainly, we have to take into account the existing dilapidated house, and take the proper steps with local authorities to safely remove it. We would work with Professor Earle to engage in a long-term archaeological study in different areas. Certainly, we would be looking at establishing the property boundaries so that we could understand exactly where the limits are of the property on the ground in relation to surrounding homes. And so we would take all of these steps, of course, after we're successful in raising the funds.
Tim, when you're looking, we talked about sort of the historical significance and some of the things you're looking at anthropologically. I'm also wondering, we mentioned that white cedar swan is turning into the bogs, but is there other sort of flora and fauna things that would be part of your research?
Well, one of the first things that you do when you excavate the preserved midden sites, I mean, midden is basically the household trash, is to look at all of the botanical shellfish remains, animal remains, so that what we can do is get a whole history of the use of the native plants and animals over a 10,000-year time period.
That would be interesting, wouldn't it?
One of the things that I would want to do first off is to try to get some pollen profiles. What we need is preserved wetlands, but these vernal pools would be an ideal place for preserved pollen, which would record the history of the changing vegetation of this landscape. And that would then be tied up to the changing uses of all of the different resources from ancient prehistory to the modern day.
Right. Michael, will you talk a little bit about your Save Land, Save Water initiative?
Sure. This is a long-range strategic plan developed by Harwich Conservation Trust, started more than a decade ago to focus on preserving priority watershed lands, those lands within the watersheds to coastal resources such as Pleasant Bay or harbors or river systems like the Herring River, for instance. Also those parcels within the watersheds to our ponds, and those parcels within the recharge areas for public water supply wells. Mm-hmm. Now, in particular, this Pleasant Bay Woodlands project crosses two of those Save Land, Save Water initiative goals. One, it's within the marine watershed to Pleasant Bay, as well as within the wellfield recharge area to municipal water supply wells that service nearly 10,000 households across Harwich. So there's a drinking water supply protection aspect of this project as well. So the Save Land, Save Water initiative, again, is really a simple but significant message. Mm-hmm. If we can preserve our priority watershed lands, then we can preserve the water resources as well.
Right. Anybody have any closing thoughts?
Well, I think just to reiterate that this is a really unique piece of property. And as Tim mentioned, it offers a microcosm for not just Harwich, but the history of Cape Cod as well. Mm-hmm. And perhaps, as you mentioned, it has that national significance, too, with the involvement of John Kendrick. And the land tells a story. As much as the value that it has as habitat, it has great value in the story that it tells of our people here.
Mm-hmm. You know, I would say, you know, picture is worth a thousand words. There's a wonderful map showing the location of the 49 acres within the Pleasant Bay watershed. It's on our website, harwichconservationtrust.org.
Yeah, we'll put a link on ours. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Great. Mm-hmm. People can read more about its natural resource and cultural significance.
Mm-hmm. Tim, any closing thoughts?
Well, I'm just feel really glad to be involved in this this project. I just feel that the potential here is really unmatched right now. Probably other areas that I would love to have saved back in the 50s when the developments were going full strong. But this is a unique position right now to take and to try to save the heritage of the Cape.
Mm. I'll be really curious to see what you find out. Timothy Earle, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at Northwestern University, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Also, thanks Michael Locke, Executive Director of the Harwich Conservation Trust, and Scott Ridley, author and historian. His book is Morning of Fire, John Kendrick's Daring American Odyssey in the Pacific. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mindy.
Coming up after a break, Christopher Sutherland joins us to talk about his book, In My Footsteps, A Cape Cod Travel Guide.